We were downstairs at the Castelli Gallery. We saw the photography exhibition. Incredible. Absolutely incredible.
Really? You like that?
The photographs downstairs at the Castelli Gallery. Great. Absolutely great. Mm-hmm. Did you?
No, I really felt it was very derivative. To me, it looked like it was straight out of Diane Arbus, but it had none of the wit.
Really? Well, you know, we didn't like him as much as the plexiglass sculpture, I will admit. I mean,
really? You liked the plexiglass, huh?
You didn't like the plexiglass sculpture either?
Oh, that's interesting. No, it
was a hell of a lot better than that steel cube. Did you see the steel cube?
Yeah, that was the worst. Now, that was brilliant to me. Absolutely brilliant.
The steel cube was brilliant?
To me, it was very textural. You know what I mean? It was perfectly integrated, and it had a marvelous kind of negative capability. The rest of the stuff downstairs was bullshit.
Hi, and welcome to the Unnamed Movie Podcast. This is Andrew. And I've already broken Damien.
That's good stuff. And this is Damien.
Douglas is still absent.
Yeah.
We can't fix his problem. I don't know what it is.
I think it's time we admit Douglas has gone to prison. All right, guys. I was doing some strange stuff with... Let's call him Ladies of the Night, and police arrested him.
Wow. And tonight, since Douglas is off, we have with us Mel Valentin from efilmcritic.com and sfstation.com, senior writer and editor, I have no idea what I'm saying anymore.
Okay, you know
what? I've been drinking tonight. How are you doing tonight?
Very good. And yourself?
How's it over there in San Fran?
It's typical May weather. Actually, it may be slightly atypical. But, you know, it's a little cold and foggy and overcast. It's been raining the last couple of days. Our rainy season usually runs from November, sometimes late October, through March or April. So it's extended a little bit longer than usual. So hopefully it'll be over very soon.
Okay.
I don't know if you know, Mel, but Jamaica is always warm and nice.
I've been melting for the last few weeks.
That's always nice weather out here. It's funny how it works in England.
Well, you know, my family is actually from Puerto Rico.
Oh, that's great.
So, you know, growing up, I would go visit, you know, my grandparents were now passed away. You know, I was very young. So we'd go there for a couple weeks in the summer, midsummer. So we'd go during really hot times, really humid times. That's what I remember the most.
Oh,
the humidity.
Anyways, let's move on with the podcast. Firstly, before we actually get into the podcast, Damien and I had a discussion about the podcast, and we decided to mix it up a little. We're going to change a little bit of the show. We're no longer going to be talking about News Weekly. That has officially been cut from the show. Instead, we'll end the show with a discussion, sometimes, hopefully most times, related to whatever we're actually reviewing that week. hopefully. Sometimes, I promise you, we're going to come up with some apeshit topics. And yeah, I hope you enjoy it. But let's kick it off with what we watched this week. Mel, what have you watched this week that you want to talk to us about?
What have I watched this week? Well, it almost feels so old and stale, just because it was last week, and, you know, when you write reviews and see so many movies, what you've seen 2 weeks ago can be 4, 5, 8 movies old. But I saw, of course, Robin Hood. That was the big film last week. And I was in the minority, unfortunately, in actually enjoying it. It has its flaws. By no means is it a perfect film. And I think it shows that whole convoluted history where it started off as a completely different script, which I'm hoping to read at some point, because it seemed pretty promising. But once Ridley Scott got involved, it completely got changed, turned into the prequel. But it's a prequel to a completely different story than what we're familiar with. And I think a lot of people sort of have that problem. Like, is it a prequel to the 1938 Adventures of Robin Hood? No, not really. It's just more a sequel to, or a prequel to, the Legend of Robin Hood. And it's a very modern take on it. And then I went back this weekend and rewatched The Adventures of Robin Hood, Errol Flynn. Totally terrific film, completely different tone. It's obviously played for the comic side, the adventure, the romance. You know, I think it was, you know, at the time, probably like that perfect four quadrant film. You know, young, old, male, female. There's something for everyone to love about it. And I don't think the new version of Robin Hood quite has that. It does have a romantic angle, which I think a lot of critics have sort of downplayed or ignored, that I thought really worked well. Something you don't ordinarily see in big budget blockbusters, that they spent so much time, which makes sense because it's Russell Crowe and Cate Blanchett, who both won Oscars, to give them meaty roles. But I really like the progression of their relationship. So those were the two most recent films that I've seen. And then the last...
I still haven't seen Robin Hood, okay? And now that I think about it, I think I've only seen the Disney Robin Hood and Robin Hood Men in Tights.
The best. The best.
Have you seen Robin Hood?
Yes.
What do you think of
it? It's not as good as Men in Tights. But I knew that going in.
I want to go and watch it. I'm probably going to see it this week.
I found it an okay movie. I didn't find it special in any way. And I think what Melly said, I went in thinking that it would be the story of Robin Hood that most people know and not really a prequel as such. But that is what it ended up being. And I guess it threw me off a little. The romance, I didn't have a problem with. But the movie on a whole, I think because we all know the legend and
the merry men part of it.
Right. Nothing he...
Yeah, there are no merry men. There really aren't any merry men. I mean, he has compatriots, but they have very little time on screen.
From what I've gathered, from what everyone said about this film, I understand that it's not the merry men side. It's before the merry men.
Right.
Like, sometimes I think it's part two of Kingdom of Heaven. They're going to be the Crusades or something. But.
Oh, it really felt like it was picking up. I mean, you could really see elements of Gladiator, Braveheart, Kingdom of Heaven. But because the opening scene, the prologue, is set basically at the tail end, King Richard of the Lionheart making his way across France, and they explicitly reference the Crusades, it feels like, oh, you know, he's just picking up where he left off with Kingdom of Heaven, you know, a few years ago. So... What I really loved and I found actually funny, but not in the way they probably intended, was that pretty much all the French characters in the film are despicable. And that completely goes contrary to the history where I guess John and Richard especially lived most of his adult life in France and barely spoke any English or whatever the equivalent was back in the 12th, 13th century. So, but he's presented obviously as an Anglo-Saxon type who, you know, doesn't speak a word of French, and the French are, you know, to the man, despicable.
Okay.
So they're one-dimensional villains. So I know, you know, people who are Francophile have had issues with that. And understandably, I guess.
Anyways, I'm going to try and see that movie this week. Anything else you saw this week, Mello, that you want to talk about?
I also saw Survival of the Dead, George A. Romero's latest film. I think it's available on Video On Demand and comes out here in San Francisco a week from Friday, the 28th. And I cannot recommend that. You know, he's really gone to the well one too many times. I just feel he's run out of things to say, but he's getting money for it. He's getting financing. He's filming up in Canada. The production values are passable. The performances are borderline acceptable, as you would expect from a low budget film. The dialogue is at times atrocious, typical Romero. You know, he throws in some CG in there, and of course you get the obligatory disembowelment of a character in the climax. But I actually saw it at a screening where George Romero appeared and did a Q&A afterwards, and he pretty much confirmed, I think, everyone's suspicions, even though the audience was really an audience that was handpicked to be, you know, lovers of his films, especially the zombie films. He was just doing it for the money. You know, at this point in his career, I think late 60s, early 70s, he's not going to get financing for anything that's not a zombie film. And if this latest one does well enough, he said he wants to do two more. And I honestly say I want to see two more Romero dead movies.
Did he even pretend to, like, want to do something else? Like, even if someone won't give him the money to do it.
He didn't mention anything that was non-zombie, and he didn't mention where he wanted to take the story further either. I think, you know, one of the things that he was honest about, to give him credit, is that, you know, the original Night of the Living Dead, I don't know if you're familiar with this or not, but because of the, they had copyrighted the original title, which I think was Night of the Flesh Eaters. There's another movie with that title, so they changed it to Night of the Living Dead. They didn't copyright that, and so it went into the public domain almost immediately. So that's why if you go online and you do a search or try to buy a DVD, you'll have 5 or 6 different versions and different cuts, because anyone who can basically get their hands on Night of the Living Dead can release their own version.
Wow, I did not know that.
Yeah, so, you know, and it was, at the, I think, early on, one of those independent films that did incredibly well. But Romero didn't see much of that or any of that once it went to the public domain, which I think was early 70s, mid-70s. So I think, you know, him and his producing partners, they obviously, I think the reason they wanted to restart the series, which they kind of did with the previous film, Diary of the Dead, was just so they could do that. So it's like, okay, here's a new series. It's set in the same universe, more or less, even though it's contemporary as opposed to late 60s. And now we own the rights to it, and we can do what we want with it and profit from it as well. Whereas Night of the Living Dead essentially belongs to everyone now.
Wow.
So yeah, there's that monetary aspect, and it's hard not to feel for him that, you know, he missed out. You know, hopefully he's living comfortably from the money he's making, but that he, you know, he should have been pretty much set for life with the money he would have made from that early film, that first film.
Okay.
And that's all I've seen.
That's all you've seen. Damien, what have you seen this week that you want to tell us about?
I saw Robin Hood, but we've talked about that. I also saw, what was the name of the movie that we were supposed to watch last week?
King of Comedy.
Right. I'm pretty sure you asked us to review that because I, in my ignorance, said Scorsese doesn't make comedies, and Andrew went out of his way to prove me wrong. except I'm still right. Scorsese doesn't make comedies. Do we plan to talk about that movie?
Well, I guess we can skip that one then. I can pick something else for next week.
Because with the exception of the final, with the exception of the bit at the end, the movie was not for comedy.
Well,
nothing funny
about
that movie.
It was a dark, dark film.
No, it was pretty annoying, is what it was. The movie found redemption, much like the character at the end when he finally did his bit.
I was actually hoping when I was watching it for the first time that we wouldn't get to see the bit.
No, I was hoping that he'd go up there and be atrocious. Just go up there and bomb completely.
But he was atrocious.
Yes.
The final bit?
Yeah.
When he went on the stage and did the comedy?
Yeah.
That was hilarious.
Oh, so you're saying it's hilarious. It's not that. You didn't hear the crickets on the television.
I don't care what you guys say. It's hilarious. But the movie, it was just, at times it was painful to watch because this dude was just so, we don't have a Hollywood here in Jamaica, and even when celebrities do come here, no one cares.
No.
So I don't know that. I really don't understand that mentality at all. Maradona came here once, and I didn't go.
The biggest Argentina fan in Jamaica.
I could have cared, I just didn't. So I don't really understand that mentality, and I see that it's really prevalent in the States. I hope that's not what happens to celebrities over there. I hope it's some extreme that Scorsese thought of in his
head. No. I think it occurs, but not
to that extent.
Like, hopefully. A little less.
Hopefully.
And I think it's more prevalent in certain areas. Kind of like how Jamaica is, like, nothing happens here.
Hey. You leave Jamaica. We're already in enough trouble. Leave Jamaica.
Yeah. You're not allowed to talk about Jamaica anymore?
No.
No? Okay.
Not until extradite a certain person.
A certain person. And we can't mention that name because...
we'll be taken off the air.
Quickly. Even though it's internet.
People lining up outside I continue watching Justified. It's still good.
Stop talking about that.
I continue watching United States of Tara. Also still good.
Okay, I like Justified.
No, yeah, but he talks about it like every week. He comes here. He's like...
Are you? Burn Notice is back in June. So guys, get ready. I know a lot of people don't really love Burn Notice as much. Yeah, like, it's cliche. Yeah. It's just a watered down James Bond, Jack Bauer type man. But it's
well produced. Every episode goes through the formula, but they do it very, very well.
Yeah, the lead he's charismatic, and he makes me want to continue watching. Dark Blue has been renewed for a second season. Have you seen any of the first season, Andrew? Why? No reason. Okay. I've just been watching a lot of TV. I started watching Black Lagoon,
the anime
that Andrew gave me. I don't get it.
I thought of all people, you don't like that one because it's ridiculous action nonsense.
Yeah, but the action is, I mean, it's anime, so they can do whatever they want with the action. But there's a story behind it that I'm not following. It's not making any sense. These guys, their job, they're essentially
pirates,
modern
day pirates.
What's it called?
Black Lagoon. Black Lagoon.
Really? Okay, that one I'm not familiar with. I haven't heard of that one.
But they're pirates. Ohio? I've never heard anything.
They're mercenaries / pirates.
And then they're pirates that work for this big overarching organization. And then the group of pirates are hands down the worst group of pirates I've ever seen in my life. There's
is this
like
a
one
comedy or
that's
no, no, no.
Woman, and she's
this is anime. Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah. But they're pretending that it's based on some kind of reality, and so there's this superwoman chick, which she's fun to watch whenever there's action. And then there's three other guys that do absolutely nothing. Like literally, they sit on the boat and they're like,
wait until you meet the nun.
I've watched 5 episodes and I'm just confused. I don't know. There was a time that me and anime were good friends. We're good friends. Mind you, it was bad anime, but that's not the point. We were friends, and
don't you remember those days where you were like, every week we must watch Bleach?
Yeah, and that has stopped. Do you know what the hell is going on in Bleach or any of this?
I remember one day randomly, because I haven't read the manga in forever, I actually clicked on the manga to go and read it, and I was like, this has gone out of proportion.
Have they reached number one? Has he killed all the dudes?
When I had
numbers?
Done it, which was about a month ago, they still hadn't finished that.
Wow, okay. All right, so if someone please send me an email when the shit is over. So that I can
catch up.
No, so I can watch a compilation of all the fights and pretend none of that happened.
Pretend.
I started watching another anime, Code Geass.
I love that one.
Which, the first 3 episodes, pretty meh. There's nothing much going on, but I keep hearing, much like Dollhouse, that it gets awesome the further you go. But I'm hearing that from the same people that said Dollhouse was awesome. Those people were wrong then.
No, I am not.
Afraid they're wrong now. Also, rewatch Firefly. The movie Serenity.
The movie
Firefly,
Serenity.
Right.
The series is Firefly.
Firefly
I get those mixed up too.
Firefly is awesome. And I started watching it after I heard that he was doing the Avengers.
Yeah, he's. It's not to direct, it's to write, isn't it?
No, he's rewriting the terrible script that they had, and he's also directing.
Oh, he's directing The Avengers, okay.
Yes.
You know, a friend of mine and I have a bet that that Joss Whedon, he thinks that Joss Whedon will be fired by January of next year. And that he'll just grab somebody else to direct it. Because Whedon has a history of, you know, writing screenplays, having them rejected. I believe he wrote at least one or two X-Men scripts. You know, he wrote the Wonder Woman script that he was attached to with DC, went through rewrites, then basically got booted off of that. So he seems to think, and of course he's had, you know, the no luck with Dollhouse and Firefly, that it's just not in the cards for Whedon to actually direct a big budget film. But we'll see. I'm a little bit more hopeful.
I think that Marvel would know
what they're getting themselves into.
I'll take that bet.
You'll take that bet?
I'll take that bet.
For which side?
Huh? For him being fired by Jenny. I'm pretty sure. That sounds like good odds.
Matthew Vaughn is going to be directing the X-Men First Class.
Yeah.
Right.
And he's rewriting the script with Jane Goldman, who I met at WonderCon back in beginning of April, I guess. Yeah. Did a quick interview for Kick-Ass. And she's been his writing partner on Kick-Ass and Stardust and, you know, they're friends through her husband, Jonathan Ross, the British TV personality. So they're very close friends. So I think he really trusts her and trusts her judgment when it comes to writing.
Having seen his movies, I like all his movies so far.
I guess the only issue I have with X-Men First Class is that she's being brought in, but they have to start production this summer.
Oh, yeah, right.
I think late summer. So they're not going to have a lot of time to rework what's already there and then just get going because it's coming out next summer.
Right.
We're going to be packed the next couple summers with superhero movies.
Yep. I imagine that in the next 4 years, it's going to burn out completely.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think the cream, as it usually does, will rise to the top.
There'll still be a couple good ones by the time we're done.
Right, but no, it won't be all superhero movies all the time. They'll find something else. But I'm glad that it's happening so that we can get all of this out of the way, in one block. So we'll know, all right, clear, that property didn't work and this worked, and we'll have... Because for a while, there was nothing. There was just X-Men. Because there was a lot of shitty Batman movies. And then we all decided superhero movies are terrible. And then there was X-Men. And then it started trickling out, and now we're getting back to... all superheroes all the time. What was I talking about? So
Firefly.
Alright, and
this is what Joss Whedon starts.
And I'm going to this is not a movie. This has nothing to do with TV yet. But there's a comic called The Sword that is it's done. I'm not sure who's putting it out. Don't remember, it doesn't matter. About this chick. Finds a magical sword and starts.
Oh, yeah, that's the Luna Brothers, right. Put out by Image, isn't it?
Yeah,
in the US?
Image Comics.
I read their previous series, Girls.
Didn't read it. The sword seems awesome. But it's. I can see it becoming Preacher awesome. And what I've heard about how it ends and. I hear that there's no real dip. It just keeps a steady pace all the way through to the end. And there's a lot of twists and turns. Not a big fan of the art style. I know it's not a comic podcast, but I don't read that many. So whenever I read one, but I don't read, period. But I highly recommend people read who aren't reading it. It's finished now, so you don't have to worry about... I think there's 24. You have to worry about reading 1 million...
24 issues.
Yeah, it's 24 issues.
Mm-hmm.
They're pretty decent.
So. I'll wait until it's out into a book, and right. I can and just buy it and
so
read through.
So that's pretty much it. I got a lot of free time.
Yeah,
and I use it wisely.
What are you saying, Mel?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was going to say, I read the previous series, Girls, as singles, and then I got in halfway through the run. And I think it was also 24 issues. Right. So I read the first 12 issues as trade paperbacks, and then I went and read them on a monthly basis. I think they have a very limited art style, so they kind of keep going back to that. So the characters look exactly the same, a lot of similarity, and the male characters look very similar outside of different hairstyles. Female characters look the same, so sometimes it's hard to tell which character is talking. It's like, oh, it's that one. Okay, great. And I thought they had a great premise for Girls. It's a sci-fi horror story, and I don't know if you're familiar with the new, Stephen King's latest novel. Was it Under the Dome?
No.
And it's a very similar premise in that this small town basically gets isolated, and they can't escape. They can't leave their town. They're completely cut off, and they can't talk to anyone out in the outside world. and these young, beautiful, naked women just start showing up. And they're not up to serve, basically. So, you know, it's fairly explicit. So there's, you know, since they're naked, they're walking around basically R-rated comics. There's plenty of gore and violence, and sides, you know, are formed.
I don't know. When I hear comic book, all I think of right now is I can't wait for Scott Pilgrim Volume 6.
I thought it had great build-up and some great characterization, and then completely let me down in the last couple issues.
Really?
They left way too much. Well, I don't know if they were just trying to set up a sequel series or not, but they left too many questions unanswered, and they really needed to do a better job of that. So I don't know if the sword... hopefully the sword does...
Leave it alone. Leave it alone. Anyways, what I watched this week, I saw for the first time The Wiz.
Why did you
Michael Jackson. Yes.
Michael Jackson, Diana Ross, and Lena Horne in the musical version of The Wizard of Oz with Richard Pryor as the wizard.
Is it because Lena Horne is dead?
No, it's not. It's not.
That would be the only excuse. Anything else here is
unacceptable.
Poor reason. Yeah, poor reason.
She wants to watch it. That's, I was like, okay.
It's not a good idea.
Who wants to watch it?
My girlfriend Michelle wanted to watch it. And she was like, Andrew, you've never seen The Wiz. Like, alright, we'll watch The Wiz.
Well, you could say you've seen it and you'll never want to see it again, right?
Yes. Like, I mean,
it's a one-time experience.
Like, I'm a musical person. Damien knows this. I love musicals. But The Wiz really wasn't that good in the musical department, to tell the truth.
It's not good in any department, I must say.
Like, I mean, I have foggy memories of the original Wizard of Oz. Mm-hmm. But I do know that I like that a lot better than The Wiz. Even though Nipsey Russell as the Tin Man was hilarious, I must say, I must give him credit. That's as much as I'll give the movie. I also saw, what's that over there? Nightmare on Elm Street, the remake that just came out with Jackie Earle Haley.
Yes, yes.
That movie was shite.
Shocking.
Yeah, it was.
Like,
it really was, you know, that really wasn't very good.
They remade a horror movie and it was bad.
Like, Nightmare on Elm Street, the original, was a movie I watched when I was very, very young. And I remember liking it. I have not watched it or any of the other movies since I was really, really young. So I don't remember what it is I actually liked about those films. I did not like this movie, and all it's done is made me rethink my childhood memories.
No, I have a theory about all horror movies. Horror movies don't work. R-rated horror should be outlawed.
Really?
Because horror doesn't scare grown people. Because you're an adult. Your brain knows that this is nonsense. With the exception
really?
Of
really? Okay.
The
I still get scared.
But we were afraid of those movies when we were children because we were children. I was terrified of Tremors and Nightmare on Elm Street.
Tremors is still awesome.
And Freddy Krueger. Yes, but you aren't scared when you watch it. You just watch it and you go, you know, this show is ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous.
Kevin Bacon, The Wiz.
They should make all horror movies PG-13 so that children can go watch them, because those are the people that have a chance of being scared. You as an adult, you're not going to go there and like, oh, if I fall asleep, somebody going to come and kill me. That's genius. Yeah, can I get back my money now? This is it. This is nonsense.
And I think one of the worst parts of this movie was the fact that it took 40 minutes for them to actually pretend there was a story to it. Okay. Like, for the first 40 minutes of this film, all it was doing was going from dream to dream to dream, kill to kill to kill, and it made no sense. So right. If you didn't know what Freddy Krueger was, you were completely lost.
Well, you are applying silly things like logic to this movie. I had some small children over, and they sat and watched Trick or Treat.
Why were you showing trick or treat to small children? Please don't become a parent quickly.
I was popping them up. It's time for them. You know, they're about 11, 12. It's full time.
11, 12. Trick or treat.
Real movies.
Dude, that's
bagger.
That's
not cool. Madness. Right? It was Rambo and trick or treat the whole day. That's what they deserve. And they were scared.
Like, parenting skills by Damien.
Not kind of sort of scared. Like, legitimately scared. we watched Snow White a little later, and when they saw when they saw her, they're one of them turned to me and they're like, does she turn into a werewolf? That was an actual question. Right? I traumatized them for life.
So anytime there's a Little Red Riding Hood.
Right, and, exactly. I would have made that. I couldn't even come up with that. Like, what are they talking about? And then I realized where she was getting it from. So she had seen the movie earlier. That's awesome.
So the children didn't complain at all?
No, children watch anything you put in front of them. That's what's great about children. You can get them to watch anything. Do you remember some of the terrible things that we watched when we were children? Let me remind you. He-Man.
I remember the movie for He-Man. It had the guy from Back to the Future, the principal. Oh my goodness.
We saw...
Which movie?
They made a He-Man movie
with time travel and shit.
Yes. And the principal from Back to the Future was in it. Oh, that movie was so bad.
And so...
Well, isn't there a remake in the works?
They've been talking about that forever. So I write that off until I hear, like, they're filming.
But, I mean, children are the only people that will get legitimately. I was afraid of Jurassic Park when I saw that. Didn't want to go outside in darkness. I knew there was a dinosaur somewhere out there waiting for me. Because I was stupid as a child and didn't make sense.
No, Jurassic Park had jump scares.
But you don't go outside now thinking that a velociraptor is going to jump out of the darkness.
I look at fences sometimes and go, is it shocked?
We need to get you some medication. That's what we need to take. But seriously, they need to. Because R-rated horror movies, it's just blur and gore at this point. They're not that scary. And in fact, all horror movies aren't that scary to us, because we're adults. We apply silly things like logic. But when you're a child, it doesn't even enter your brain. You're like, what? So I can't sleep? I'd imagine showing one of them Freddy Krueger at this point. They'd never go to sleep.
Anyways, there's one more movie I want to talk about before we move on. I saw A Few Dollars More, the sequel to Office Full of Dollars, and I'm going to watch Good, Bad, the Ugly tomorrow.
Good.
A Few Dollars More, like, I didn't know how they could progress this in a way that it would be awesome, but...
They can't make this more awesome.
I have another entry for the argument of when sequels are better than the original. I love that they introduced the Man in Black. Like, he was one of the most awesome characters gotten in a film.
Yeah, you couldn't even believe it.
And I actually prefer this a lot more than to A Fistful of Dollars. However, at the same time, I don't want to think about it in conjunction with Yojimbo. I think of Yojimbo by itself. Because I still think Yojimbo is the better one versus Fistful of Dollars. But Clint Eastwood is just exponentially greater in this movie.
Which makes it better. And the Man in Black.
It's fantastic. Damien, I think I have to officially tell you that I was wrong.
Oh, thank you. That's good to hear.
Westerns can be good.
Uh-huh.
Oh, and while we're at it, last week, since we didn't record, I also saw Magnificent Seven.
Mm-hmm.
Which...
The first one?
The Magnificent Seven.
There's like
You really don't need to say anything about
that. The 1960 version with Charles Bronson.
Oh, yeah.
Steve McQueen.
So what happened is
the remake of Seven Samurai, right?
Yeah, the remake of Seven Samurai, and I'm actually surprised that film, like, that might be one of the best remakes I've seen in a long time. Because for whenever you pick a movie as a great remake, as an argument for why remakes can be good, is that they instead of just cutting scene for scene, filming scene for scene, they actually tried to make it into their own version. They realized that they can't do what Seven Samurai did.
Damn right.
So they decided to make it slightly more action-oriented. They decided to have the same characters, but at the same time, it felt like they glanced over the development that they had in Seven Samurai just for that action... Magnificent Seven.
Right, they cast actors that were good enough that people wouldn't stick. It wouldn't be a sticking point when they didn't develop these characters. You just assume that based on the guys who were acting, based on the actors, these guys are awesome. That's all. They made 4, I think.
They made 4? Really?
Second one.
I know there were sequels, but right. I've never seen any of those, right. And I really have no intention.
The second one, I think only 2 of the actors
really
from the initial 7 were in it, and then the 3rd and 4th one had none of them. And believe me, they get progressively worse.
Well, at the end of the first one, there are 3 of them alive.
Right.
And
right,
one of them stays with the town. So you technically only need the 2. And I'm sure they didn't get Steve McQueen back.
No, they didn't. But all the 3 are bad. You saw the great one. You're welcome, Andrew.
You're don't worry. I'll find examples of why I was just telling that.
Yeah, Australia. Ding, 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 ding.
So, trailers this week.
Super 8.
No. I don't even want to talk about that.
I hate that trailer. I don't care what anyone says. Oh, the teaser is amazing. That teaser is garbage. Nothing. What
no.
on earth?
It suffers from being a J.J. Abrams trailer.
Not on earth.
He doesn't want to tell you fucking anything about the
then
movie.
Then why put out the trailer?
He just wants to announce I exist.
Yeah, but we knew that. No,
it's kind of like...
He's just trying to repeat this Cloverfield experience. But I think a lot of people... I don't know, but... Well, maybe I'm speaking out of turn to speaking for other people, but... there was so much excitement around Cloverfield and all the clues and all the viral stuff that was going on, and he's just trying to duplicate that, but I think that was a one-time experience.
Exactly.
But
you
he
know?
Did the
I mean,
same
at
thing
the end,
for
you
Star
get the film, and it's just a film, and it's not... Cloverfield wasn't even that strong. It just had a gimmick going for it, and, you know, it didn't explain a lot. It just left a lot of stuff unexplained, and, you know, I think a lot of people are starting to feel like, well, here we go again. We're going to have a whole year of build-up and hype related to Super 8, and is it going to pay off? Is it going to be worth the investment in time and energy for the entire length of that time? Or can we just wait, you know, closer to the time it comes out and then start looking into it again? I don't know.
What you're saying about he did the same thing with Star Trek. No. Remember the first Star Trek trailer? Everyone was happy with the first Star Trek trailer.
I'm talking about the teaser.
What was the teaser?
The teaser came out. It's actually... I can show it to you because it's on the Iron Man DVD I have. Mm. Where all it is the camera panning around a metal object. And eventually he shows you that they're building the Enterprise and then it's done. It's around 30 seconds long and they ran that for so long.
I'm glad. All I saw was the first trailer. That's all I care about. This teaser trailer.
He does it all the while and he's like, look, this movie exists. I am doing it. You know it's going to be awesome.
Yeah, but
talk to you
that.
Later.
We knew that.
I know.
We need a teaser trailer.
But that's what he does is what I'm saying. It's what he does.
Let's talk about
it. Well, I do think it was necessary for Star Trek just because they wanted to get, you know, the old fans and excited.
I think they did it especially because they wanted to run something at the previous year's Comic-Con.
Of course, yeah.
Because they were like, we can't not have something at Comic-Con. We have to. And we don't have anything, so... Let's show them this that we did in a week. In our basement.
So awesome.
Well, it worked for Tron, right? I mean, Tron, they had just that test footage.
The light cycles.
Right, and that was like 2 years ago.
Awesome.
And I think then they sort of cleaned it up and showed it again the following year. And that's what they released as sort of, it wasn't even a teaser trailer because it's not even in a film. And it's a great little sequence. And then they
However,
the teaser.
I will argue for Tron in the sense that unlike Star Trek, Cloverfield, and now Super 8, the Tron teaser is giving us actual information. I mean, not a lot, other than it exists. It's giving us actual information, like certain changes they're making to the world, technological changes they're making to the world now, and how it's... Like, when you saw that teaser, you... Even if you had seen the original Tron and you were trying to conceive what Tron 2 would look like, if they were going to keep the old 80s vibe, or whatever you knew after you saw that little sequence with the cycles, because that's what everyone wants to see.
Right.
That this is going to be like exponentially, it's going to be like Wolfenstein upgrade. When you played the original Wolfenstein game and then you saw the Wolfenstein, what was that one that came out like around Return to Castle Wolfenstein? When you look at the differences in those games, that's how you look at the differences between Tron 1 and Tron 2. They're fully making it proper 3D, three-dimensional world where they can actually move on all axes. And it just looks awesome. And it also gave you that Jeff Bridges was actually going to be in it.
Right. Yeah. No. I don't disagree. It was definitely nicely done.
Tron is this year, right?
It's December.
Yeah, I can't believe it. You know, that's the one I was really hoping for. If that was coming out this summer, then I think I would have had more than one movie to look forward to. The other one being Inception, of course. But yeah, Saving Tron. And actually, I have a coworker's. Well, my very slim connection to Tron is that a coworker's boyfriend is a visual effects supervisor, and he's working on Tron right now. And his contract ends in December. But he used to work for Lucasfilm and ILM. And
you don't give him, your terabyte hard drive to copy everything he has for you?
I know, no. Well, the only time I try to talk to her or about it, and, you know, it's usually the NDA, non-disclosure agreement. He can't tell. I'm sure he tells her a lot. And probably, you know, maybe there's footage and she'll probably get to see it in advance. But, you know, she hasn't budged. It'd be great to hear more about it from him. But, I mean, the only thing I've heard was that there was a specific piece of software that he wanted to use, which I guess is not proprietary to Disney, or that his group wanted to use for whatever it is that they're doing. But Disney circumvented him or said no and went with some software that he thought was inferior.
Yeah.
I don't think it was a question of cost. It was just something that he wanted for his group that he thought would work better. Now you have me curious. I'm like, yeah, I really need to try to talk to her again. Because she actually relocated down.
When you get all of those video files of all of the film, I can give you my password for my server. You can upload it and I'll copy it and I'll promise no one will get it. Just me.
Right. Well, no, you know, WonderCon was just the beginning of April here in San Francisco, and I was really hoping that the Disney presentation would have something related to Tron, and it didn't. So I guess it's Comic-Con that they'll have, you know, an extended teaser or trailer and some additional footage. But all they did at WonderCon was just sort of this outdoor stunt where they had what's his name? Bruce Boxleitner, pretending to be Alan Bradley. I don't know if you saw it online or not. They did a, you know, they taped it and put it online where he's playing the Alan Bradley character as the CEO of NCOM, doing a presentation in front of a group where a bunch of people disrupt the presentation, running around with posters and signs saying Flynn lives, and then someone jumps out of a plane. I'm sorry, a helicopter parachutes down. So all of that was done live. So people who were invited to this event, which was outdoors, got to see that. But that was essentially all it was. They didn't do anything else that was Tron related during that time.
Okay. Well.
Which was disappointing.
You were saying something, Mel?
Oh no! I was saying it was disappointing because I wanted to see additional footage.
Oh. Okay.
I guess I should admit, or maybe I shouldn't admit that. Yeah, you know. I've downloaded that trailer multiple times. I've downloaded the trailer, watched it many times, trying to glean out some of the clues, like you were saying, about how they've expanded and changed the world inside Tron, inside the virtual world. The different types of games, I know they have, in addition to light cycles, light cars. I've seen photos of those. But it seems like they really have expanded this whole arena and audiences to watch the games. So it does have sort of a gladiator feel to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it'd just be great if it was coming out this summer. That's all I can say.
Okay. Well, the trailers that came out this week, there was Easy A with Emma Stone.
Let me just begin by saying that there are two sides to every story, and this is my side, the right one. I used to be anonymous, and nothing, a non-entity. Olive. That's your name, right? Yeah. We've had 9 classes together since kindergarten. Mm-hmm. So here it is. part one.
Do you want to go out with me?
Brandon, just a couple hours ago, you told me you were gay.
You said I should pretend to be straight.
I didn't mean with me.
I am tormented every day at school. Just one good imaginary fling.
Which brings us to part two.
Is that Olive with Brandon?
No, grunt and make it convincing.
Oh.
Stop!
Oh, I'm not gonna stop!
You ready for the grand finale?
Yeah.
What?
Thank you.
What's up?
Damien, what did you think of this trailer?
It looks generic. And they're still... I was saying to Andrew that none of the people in the movie look like they belong in high school. They look kind of old. And Andrew is saying that Hollywood has been doing it for years. But I don't think I realized it until... pretty much a while ago. None of those people belong.
Well, just going back to Nightmare on Elm Street briefly, all of those actors were in their early to mid-20s.
Wow.
And the first actress is the blonde, who seems to be the lead but isn't.
Yeah.
You know, she's like 24, 25. Saying, no, you don't look like a senior in high school. You really look like you're in your mid-20s. It's one thing. The other actress who ends up playing Nancy, who becomes the lead, the final girl, etc., she at least looks like she could be in high school, but none of the other actors did, and it really it threw me out of the film. It's like, wait a second, your lead blonde actress just doesn't look like she's 17. You know, she's not bad talent wise. She's easy on the eyes, but I can't buy her as a 17-year-old. And you're right. I mean, I think Emma Stone is how old is Emma Stone?
Maybe I actually don't know, but she definitely doesn't look 18.
Not in high school.
I mean, it can be deceptive. Well, she is 22.
Like, even when you think about it, like, she was in Superbad, like, what was it, 2 years ago?
3 years ago.
Superbad,
yeah, 2006. Well, that's the part of the problem, too, right, is that, well, they're playing actors who end up playing high school characters for 5, 6, 7 years. Like, wait a second. How many years have you been in high school? Huh. And that actor who played, like, the gay friend in the...
Oh, in the trailer? I don't even know his name.
Dan Bird.
He was in
the Hills Have Eyes remake.
I never saw that one. It's a horror
film. He was on Heroes, Greek. I'm trying to think. What else? Mortuary. Okay, you probably don't. Oh, the Salem's Lot remake with Rob Lowe. Which unfortunately had Rob Lowe in it.
What remake?
But, yeah, there was a TV miniseries remake in 2004.
What was it?
That actually looked fantastic. It's a remake of the... it's also an adaptation of Stephen King's novel from the late 70s. There was an original late 70s version, which, when I was a kid, absolutely terrified me. Because the vampire looks very much like the Nosferatu vampire from the early 20s film.
Oh, I like that movie.
And then they did a... Yes, but it's but then they did a remake series. God, I can't believe that was 6 years ago. Salem's Lot with Rob Lowe in the lead and Rutger Hauer as the vampire, which is a very bad decision. But anyway, I'm sorry, I'm taking you away from what we're talking about. But this Dan Bird guy, he's been around for, I'm just looking at, you know, IMDb.
Yeah.
He's been around for 11 years. So he's still playing a high schooler, and he's actually 25. So that's a little bit too long.
And Andrew could play high school.
No.
You look like a child.
You too.
Yeah.
But there should be a cutoff, don't you think? Like, if you played a high schooler for more than 40 actual years, you can't play him anymore, even if you look the age.
You know what I think did it for this rule? Fonz.
Oh yeah. Well, Henry Winkler was like,
how long was
playing.
was he the Fonz, and he was like 40 something years old at the time, and he was playing a 20 something.
Yeah, that was remarkable, and that show lasted for so long. So he really did age noticeably, I think, by the end.
Yeah.
I think Ron Howard actually lost hair during that show.
Oh, right. Well, I think one of the reasons why he left is exactly that. I mean, he wanted to pursue a directing career, but I think I must have read this in an interview somewhere a long time ago, him saying that he wanted to leave because he thought he was too old to play the role anymore, which I almost have to admire, you know?
Yeah. My only thing about this trailer is that I agree with Damien. It looks very generic and very bad, but at the same time, I kind of like Emma Stone. I find her really funny.
This is a problem.
And I remember even like a month or so back, they released a little clip, which obviously has nothing to do with the film other than it had Emma Stone singing. I can't even remember the song. It had this birthday card which sang a song and she was just singing it. It was like a minute long and like it was nothing, but it kind of made me laugh. And that's what I think when I look at this movie. I'm like, Emma Stone will probably make me laugh.
She's your new Zoe. Is she the new Zoe? Now that Zoe has sold out and gone TV, you need someone to replace her.
I need someone to replace Zoe.
She's
in
here.
Well, but she shown some good timing, comic timing.
Yeah.
And I liked her quite a bit in Zombieland.
Oh, I love her in Zombieland.
Although, you know, there she wasn't really doing a comedic role, but I think she really fit that ensemble well.
I think she's best when she's just like that, where she's not trying to be outright comedic, but she's just keeping it straight and really quick with her wit and everything. It's really good.
Yeah.
Okay. Moving on to the next trailer.
Barney's Version, film starring Paul Giamatti.
Barney Bonowski.
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 Ofsky.
Bonowski.
It's fine.
Mazel tov.
Or Miriam.
For the first time in my life, I am truly in love.
So am I.
Run away with me.
Are you out of your mind?
No, I'm bent over backwards in love.
You're a married man, and I won't be involved with you in any way.
I have to get a divorce.
What? You're married to a woman who has a beautiful rack.
This is the paternal wisdom I'm gonna get.
Many successful marriages have been built on far less.
And a smattering of other...
Smattering of other babies. People, including Dustin Hoffman. Mel, what did you think of this trailer?
I think, like I said earlier, the first bad sign was seeing Dustin Hoffman's name attached, but luckily, because he hasn't done anything of note, 10, 15 years, even longer. I mean, Minnie Driver, likewise, I think she's best as a TV actress. She hasn't done very
much.
Whatever
happened to that TV show she was in with Eddie Izzard?
I'm going in with some biases against particular actors, but I like Paul Giamatti, Bruce Greenwood, so I think that's a plus, or their pluses to it. The trailer has some snap, and it moved, had some good dialogue. So I think it has some promise. I don't know much more than that. So I'll leave it at that. It looks like it has some promise. I'll give it a shot.
You see, my only problem with this is it looks like Paul Giamatti is one of these actors that I really like. But over the years and seeing everything, like, I'm starting to see a pattern. And last year he did Cold Souls, which was a film that I did not like at all.
I didn't see that.
It wasn't funny at all. It looked like it was going to play this dark, dramatic humor about celebrities and stuff, but not funny at all as far as I'm concerned. I'm sure Damien loves it. You didn't see it? Well, I'm sure next week you'll say you've seen it and you love it. And for some reason, I'm kind of staring at this film with that feeling that it's going to turn out to be really boring and not that funny. I mean, you say Dustin Hoffman, that's definitely a bad thing nowadays. I mean, nowadays, when I think of Dustin Hoffman, I think of that shitty movie I made us watch. What was it again? The Before Sunrise remake with older people, Last Chance Harvey. And I think pains me the most is that I made my parents watch both of those films, Before Sunrise and Last Chance Harvey, and they hate Before Sunrise and love Last Chance Harvey. And I wonder if it's an age thing, because we're like 20 something watching Before Sunrise, and we're like, that's awesome, and they're how old, I don't want to say, for some reason, that they're watching 50-year-olds kept falling in love in Last Chance Harvey. They're like, that's awesome. But that movie was not good. You know what was the last thing that I liked Dustin Hoffman in, but I admit to not thinking it as the greatest film in the world, and you're going to tell me I'm being a child, Mr. Mongorium's Wonder Emporium.
Wow. At least you knew what I was doing.
Oh, I won't say I detest that movie, but I disliked it intensely. And I disliked it intensely primarily because of his performance.
Really?
Thank you.
I just felt like he was, you know, just rechanneling his Rain Man character and, you know, the shuffling, stumbling, the speech patterns.
That movie was bad.
You know, the movie was just really trying too hard. I don't know.
By the way, another movie I like Jason Bateman in.
What was that?
That movie.
The same terrible
movie. The same terrible movie. Yeah, I can't really say anything good about this trailer.
That's pretty bad. Can we talk about also movies that we want to see?
But there
Inception.
Are no. No.
You see that trailer? I love it.
If we recorded last week, we would have talked about that trailer. But you know what? You decided to be a girl and stay home.
Yeah, you're right.
Because it was what was the excuse? It was raining.
And if you don't know, we treat rain like lava here in Jamaica. Country shuts down. No one goes anywhere. But it's raining. What else? There was the Adjustment Bureau that came out last week too. I like that trailer. Why did we talk about terrible trailers in this movie? What's the hype? Robin Hood is out. What's the next big movie that's supposedly coming out?
Get Him to the Greek. And Shrek.
Shrek comes out on Friday.
Yes! Money in my
Gruber. At least here. The next week is Sex and the City 2.
Oh, that movie comes out soon. Awesome.
Yeah,
you want to know why I like that? Not because I want to watch a movie, but because I won't have to see the trailer anymore when I go to the theater.
Oh, yeah. You're not alone. And the best part, well, both the first Sex and the City movie and the second one are each 144 minutes long.
You see, this is what
I don't get. Why would they be 2.5 hours long?
No, I'm not even going to get you with the runtime, right? I'm going to admit this. I have seen all of the actual series, and my excuse, which Damon will write off as complete rubbish, was that at this point in time in my household, we did not have cable. We had the dish. So it was a decision between local television or whatever was on the dish.
Or
at 9 o'clock at night, I'm not going outside to play football at 9 o'clock at night.
Or watching grass grow.
My mother loved Sex and the City, so she would always have it on. And right after Sex and the City was a show I loved called Arliss. So I would put up with the half an hour of Sex and the City just to get to Arliss. Every week.
Sorry.
And you couldn't go make a sandwich in the half an hour or cook yourself something.
Sometimes I'd go off and come back, but generally I actually watch the show.
Sick man.
And then they made the film with the excuse, the first film with the excuse of people didn't get the ending they wanted, so we want to give them the ending of Horseface getting with Big. I can't remember.
Oh, did you just call it Horseface? Ouch.
Yeah, she's not that pretty, I must say.
No. Well, you know what? If you go back and see some of her early roles when she's in her early mid-20s, yeah, I would say, yeah, she was attractive. I found her attractive. She was in a show years ago called Square Pegs, I think.
Wow. I'm sure she looked like a miniature horse, like a foal.
Yeah, a pony.
Well, she's always had a long face, obviously, but I think she's an object lesson for older women that if you try to stay too thin, you're just not going to look good. And she really does not look good. It's a pet peeve of mine. Older women who, sure, when they're in their teens and 20s were thin, they look fine, but then they try to retain that look, and it just, you know, they look emaciated. They look like they've been sick. And I think if she allowed herself to fill out a little bit more, she would have aged more gracefully. But she's trying to keep that really thin look, and it doesn't work with someone who has a long face. So anyway, that's my 2 cents worth.
So yeah, the number one movie was made.
I thought that she was cute.
Number one movie was made because people didn't get the ending they liked. So the number one movie was made, and people got the ending they liked in that they got together, and everyone did this and that. But now they're fucking making part two. Why? Because it made money. And
what?
And you know,
I don't know. I think there is some artistic reason for making part two.
Actually, I have a better reason for making part two. I believe it's that Sarah Jessica Parker and HBO realized that without this franchise, the other three women wouldn't have a career.
Absolutely. who's done anything? Kim Cattrall was in that Roman Polanski movie.
And I heard she was terrible. I still haven't seen it, though.
Well, I don't know what kind of accent she was trying. I just didn't understand. They should have just, if she couldn't pull it off, she should have just played an American. You know, just find that excuse for the character being in England, you know? It's like, oh, she's
like every other Hollywood film.
It's just better than to try to fake an accent than to have someone, you know, just throw in a line there. I mean, they did that with all the Jean-Claude Van Damme films, right? Back in the 80s and 90s, they always found a way for him to be like a Frenchman or, you know, French-American or something so that you wouldn't. And Schwarzenegger, likewise. No one, like, questions his accent, even though he's playing an American character. Like, wait, what?
They just didn't have him talk a lot.
For a while.
You stand there and look menacing, and we'll have the dialogue over there.
Oh, right. It just minimized the dialogue.
And we'll call you when
so you're right. Sex in the City made $152 million U.S.
It made a lot of cash. Women ran to it.
Yes.
Well, I mean, one of the arguments you can make is that it's an underserved group. I mean, there are obviously always, you know, what, probably 10, 12 romantic comedies that come out a year. But this had the built-in audience from the series, the attachment to the characters. I was shocked that it did as well as it did. And it just kept going and going and going.
Let's stop talking about it.
Yeah, this depresses me. Let's move on to our review.
Okay.
So this week we're going to be talking about Lance Hammer's film. Help me pronounce Ballast, because I've been told 3 times today that I'm pronouncing it wrong.
What were you pronouncing as Ballast?
I was saying Ballast. Is it Ballast?
Oh,
ballast.
It doesn't matter.
Like someone told me the accents on the first air.
Does
some chat.
Does it really matter? No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
Yeah, whatever.
James, what's wrong? What's going on with you today? Come here. What's wrong? Come here. Tell me. I need $100. You need $100 for what?
I broke somebody's TV.
You broke somebody's TV? Whose? Sit down.
Damien chose this film. So, Damien, why don't you tell the people what it's about?
It's about black people. Poor black people. Well, not really.
Not directed by Tyler Perry?
Not directed by Tyler Perry.
Yeah, it's not a comedy.
No. Although
it's an anti-comedy.
There is comedy in it. It's not a comedy. Unintentional, I might add. It's not a comedy. So, Ballast is focused on this family where the mother and the child are separated from the father and his brother, and at the start of the movie the father offs himself, and the rest of the story is what happens when his son gets himself and his mother into problems and how they have to fall back and deal with their husband, their uncle. And I chose this movie because when did it come out? Like a year, 2 years ago?
It officially was 2008, but I think it really didn't get a big release, so it's not really sure.
I think it came out here domestically last spring, but it was shown and won a couple awards at Sundance in 2008. So basically 2 years ago, January.
This movie has won a lot of awards, and people talk about this movie like it is one of the best movies they've ever seen. I was speaking to a friend, I don't think he's going to be a friend for much longer, and he doesn't watch a lot of movies, and he was like, oh, this movie is great. It's this, it's that. And finally said, you know what, I need to watch this
talk
movie.
Talk me so.
But I need to find a reason to watch this movie.
Oh.
This podcast.
Oh.
Is a good enough.
I was sitting, you know, I get this feeling when I'm watching these movies. I'm like, did Damien pick this for just to punish me?
So that, no, this movie is like another movie review, Goodbye Solo, where it is meant to be extremely depressing. It is meant at the end to give some form of hope. But it fails on both accounts. What it does is make you realize that there's a lot of movies out there that are intentionally or unintentionally extremely pretentious and extremely boring at the same time. This movie did nothing. Nothing at all to make me think or learn anything else. It was just grandstanding and... I mean, in the movie, literally, this movie went nowhere in terms of location.
Oh, Damien, you don't know how happy you've made me today.
I guess I'm in the minority on this one, too. All right. First Robin Hood and now Dallas.
Character development. Literally, nothing happened in this movie.
Actually, Mel, if you're positive, it means we're in the minority. You're in the majority,
right,
there.
Because there's a lot of people that absolutely love this movie.
And I think it's just pretentious critics. Probably Mel is one of those.
It's.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes I can't get around that, yes.
If this movie was balanced, a novel by Sapphire, I'd have understood what's going on.
Oh, no, don't go there. I really hated that movie.
Now, see, Oprah should have got up on stage and like, this is the best movie I've ever seen. And
Precious?
It gives you such insight into black people's life. I don't understand. Look, I'm black, alright? And there was a time I was poor. I'm not poor anymore. Prostitution. Very lucrative. And I've seen people in situations akin to the situation that these people are in, but none of their lives are anywhere near as depressing. It just isn't, and they play up the depression and helplessness of these people, and they're looking over key factors like the father owned a store and two houses. Why were they living they were living basically hand to mouth?
It's Mississippi. Mississippi is one of the poorest states in the United States. It's literally at the bottom as far as like per capita. You know what people make there is really surprisingly low, and so there's widespread poverty. So even someone who's running a store, and basically, you know, I don't know if he owns the property that the store is in, but he's also, you know, he essentially has to purchase all of the goods in the store. I think it's an open question how much money he can actually make, and I think they mentioned in the film that the property that they live on is worth more than the houses. And that was left to the two brothers, and so that's why the later development in the film about the female character and the son moving in there, because you know that's basically all that they have is basically the property, but you never get a sense obviously of the life outside. They never actually enter. Is there a town they live in? Because all you see is basically the open field, the store, and the houses they live in. Maybe the hospital at the beginning. So you don't get a sense of what the size of the town they live in, kind of population. So I mean, Hammer really just leaves so much of this
up
in the air.
I think the answer to your question right there is this is really indie filmmaking, where the guy realizes I have these two locations and a camera.
Let's go.
we'll worry about the rest of it later.
I mean, the story it just dragged, and it was.
I thought it, you know, well, it's one of, you know, I guess I should admit that one of my favorite directors is Robert Bresson, French director, and I saw a lot of that in this. Although I think his films are absolutely amazing once you really start digging into them and all the different layers that he's and his different approach to filmmaking and shot selection and visual composition. which is unlike other directors. But if you ever get a chance to see Man Escaped, which is one of my top 10 films of all time, I highly, highly recommend it. You might be bored, or you might be bored at first, but you start getting pulled into the story bit by bit and into this character's plight. And it's just about it's set in World War II. You don't really get much of the world outside of prison. And it's about a French resistance fighter who gets caught. And the entire film is about him preparing and attempting to escape. And if you think that wouldn't be a story that could be stretched into 90 minutes, you'd be surprised. And his other films very much follow that same pattern where there's very little dialogue, uses non-actors. The one thing I didn't like about Ballast was he was using the typical shaky cam. There's several scenes where I really wish he would have cleaned that up a little bit, you know?
I think that's more a question of what he had on hand than a decision, really.
I mean, shaky
cam. Where there was an aesthetic choice. Because the film didn't look bad.
No, you know, not at all.
Did win for cinematography? It didn't.
Right. The cinematography looked fine. I mean, he didn't do too much shaky cam. There's just several scenes where I felt that he had it fairly static, and then all of a sudden, you know, because he's raising the tension in the scene, he's starting to shake it a little bit more. So I thought it was actually intentional on his part. And I could be wrong.
The movie that you are talking about sounds far better.
And he's still a traditional goal-oriented character.
It actually, the movie you mentioned kind of reminds me of Paths of Glory a little bit, which I really loved. Yeah.
Sounds good. No, this
and
movie,
they're the same decade, actually.
Oh.
Man Escaped is a late 50s black and white film.
I mean, I think this movie felt a little bit too cliche. The fact that the son is into drugs, which, I mean, I kind of understand, but what I don't understand is the guys who were chasing after him, right, they caught up to him and his mother, and he tried to shoot them, and all they did was hit him in the face.
Well, you see, herein lies my thing. I'm willing to buy that one.
I live in Germany.
No,
it doesn't work like that.
I'm semi willing to buy that one. I'm willing to let that one pass. Mm-hmm. However, what I don't get, and you know, tell me I'm an idiot, okay? What I don't get is how the movie begins with this child holding up his uncle, getting money to buy drugs, gets high every other day, doesn't go to school, doesn't do nothing, and then 20 minutes later, the moment he gets hit in the face along with his mother, mm-hmm. he's no longer wanting drugs. Mm-hmm. There is no sign of anything. No, but usually there is some sort of...
And that's because it doesn't make sense. They were going to steal his Xbox for the money, right? They drug him and his mother out of the car, hit both of them, and left her car. Why not take the car and sell it? Since it's clearly the money they're after, and not revenge on this silly youth. And the uncle shooting himself, really? And the white dude,
what happened to him?
Again, what in God's name is happening? Is he the benefactor?
Well, I thought the setup initially was since they're twins. Well, you know, it's the same actor playing the dual role.
No, but at the beginning of the film, when the uncle gets shot...
He shoots himself. He shoots himself, right?
There's this white guy who takes his dog, and you see him for, 2 minutes total in the film?
And then he comes back.
And he never returns to the story.
Yeah.
He returns when he gives him the dog.
Yeah, that's about it.
And then that's it.
Like, you'd think that once they move into that location, you would at least see the dude.
Where's his arc? What is his motivation? He's a good Samaritan. He's Mother Teresa. That's it. He just walks around knocking on black people's door and like, are you shot? Can I take
I thought the connection there was the store. And that the old white dude character was friends with the brother. Because he asked for him at the beginning. And then he's the one who walks in and finds the body. So I think there's an implied friendship there, if not with the surviving brother, then with the other brother. And that was his concern, that he died, and then, you know, he sees Lawrence in a depressed state, and then Lawrence attempts to commit suicide. And that I bought completely, because if you set it up as they don't have anybody else. They're alone. They're twins. They have that close relationship, you know, for an entire lifetime. So I think the emotional state of one can impact the emotional state of the other. You know, maybe they're both naturally depressive people. So, I agree with you that the subplot involving the drug dealers wasn't particularly well handled. I mean, we always have expectations because we've seen so many movies of what, you know, you introduce these characters, they're going to come back. Just like you were referring to the white character. It's like, hey, he's introduced at the beginning of the film. The expectation is he's going to have some sort of recurring role. Then he doesn't. And, you know, the mother doesn't get introduced until later. She actually becomes a dominant character by the second half of the film. And you have, again, like you said, the drug dealers who you think are going to play a major role. I mean, the role that they play is basically once they confront the mother and James, forcing them to move. They're moving for their personal safety.
So, when
but you're right about why. I mean, I'm buying my understanding or the way I'm reading that situation was that when they pulled them over and beat them up, that they didn't have guns on them.
Yeah.
And if they did, they would have shot and killed.
At least a child.
What's that?
At least a child.
Right. Well, with her standing in the way and her being a witness, I wouldn't expect her to survive either.
I didn't read these people as smart individuals.
Yeah. No, well, and they also seem pretty young too.
Yeah.
You know, so I almost got the sense that they were playing at being, you know, tough drug dealers when in fact they were really low level drug dealers who were just hanging around one house.
Mm-hmm.
So they, you know, they weren't really as tough as they seemed. You know,
well,
except
when
they kind of ripped them off.
All right, before we move on, the one thing I wanted to bring up about this film, there's a lot of aspects to this film. I especially want to talk about the introduction to this film when it just begins. You have, of course, as we've mentioned, the uncle shooting himself and things that occur. But generally, for that first, like, 10-15-minute area of the film, there's absolutely no dialogue. There's just action occurring. And I was actually watching this going, like, Damon's going to say he loves this because it reminds me of Fish Tank. Damon's going to love this because it reminds me of Fish Tank. Because I was just thinking about Fish Tank the whole time. I was like, yes, I could get up and go and make myself some supper and I would come back and I would have missed nothing. The child would just be walking around. We talk about all these other characters in the film who seem to dominate or walk out or just be mentioned in the film, but really, the focal point is really the child, right? And even when you look at the title of this film, Ballast...
No, it was the child.
Yeah.
Ballast, you mean?
Huh?
Balance?
Yeah, I'm going to stop saying that word. The title of this film, Black. It's. I didn't know there was an actual word. It stands for a heavy material used to stabilize a ship or an airship. So basically, this film is all about taking this family, the mother and child, and somehow stabilizing them out of this ridiculous scenario that they're currently in. And I get that that's what the film is about. However, boring me to tears and showing me absolute baggage. Little to no development for, what was it, 100 minutes?
Any of the career.
Really, really didn't help my enjoyment. And now that I think back at it, talking to you, Mel, I do see that there was more development that I'm willing to admit to. But it just felt so out of place so many times. Like, if you... Like I feel almost that if you had this in script form and someone with a good sense could actually go through it and fix all the problems and make it a good film.
No, like reading it would have. I think it would make a far better book than it did a movie.
So maybe it would have been too traditional. Film, you know, if you start adding more structure, more dialogue. I mean, one of the things that I like, and maybe it's because I see so many films, is that I do want to see almost a cross-section of films, you know? I don't mind seeing, and I totally enjoy the big budget blockbuster films most of the time, but I want to see the small films that try to do more with less.
and films, and I think I have almost an inherent attraction to films that don't use a lot of dialogue, that are very spare. And again, that goes back to watching a movie or a director like Robert Bresson, who used very, very little. They didn't use any music. What I found also interesting...
There's
only one scene with music in the entire film,
yeah.
And it's set in Mississippi, in the Delta, which is where the blues started. You know, this is, you know, a more traditional filmmaker would have put music everywhere in the film, you know, and it's not there. And so you're just depending on a natural sound. And to me, that almost gives me a more intense experience. I hate to use the word immersive because it gets so overused, especially in relation to 3D. But when you have a film that's sort of breaking the conventions of what we expect from film like this, like, you know, a lot of films that sort of fall into that outer edge and are described as minimalist, it makes you pay more attention in a different way than I think the films that you see them all the time that almost make you passive because you know exactly how they're going to turn out. You know that, oh, the drug dealers are introduced. Well, there's going to be a violent incident later on. Oh, they're going to come back in the third act. And he doesn't go that traditional route with these characters. And, you know, you expect a scene with the little boy where he's going to finally talk and explain himself. But, you know, he's a passive character, but he's also introspective, and he hasn't reached that point in his life yet where he can express himself clearly. And that, to me, was an attractive part of the film. That it pulled me in a little bit more because he wasn't making that choice of, oh, now the character is going to tell you all of his emotions and everything is going through his head. You have to sort of glean that from his behavior. You know, how listless he is, you know, how he just wanders around, you know, how little there is for him to do. The only pleasure he seems to get is, and even then he's still pretty passive, is in playing, I guess, as an Xbox, right?
Yeah.
And that's it, you know, and that's his entire life. It's really small and cramped. He's not going to school, doesn't have any friends. So I think it's, you know, one of the things is we expect so much from the film, but in effect, it's just giving us a snapshot of their lives at the lowest point, or one of the lowest points. And then, like you were saying earlier, that brief glimmer at the end, you know, which I almost missed because I think my DVD skipped. You know, there are a lot of jump cuts. I'm like, wait, what just happened? And I missed the presence of the older character in the car. So my DVD just like skipped, and I was like, oh, because then the last shots are the boy in the back of the car.
Yeah.
So I had to rewind it to figure out exactly what was happening. So I think a lot of it, you know, for me is just the experience of something that's different out of the mainstream. It's telling a very small story, you know, it's giving some local detail and flavor. I think there's still something universal about it too, that there are, in fact, not everyone reacts the same way to these types of situations. And I think you have three characters who, you know, are sinking by when we meet them. You know, they're each in a really negative place. And the fact that they find a little emotional connection by the end, you know, it left me relieved. And it felt realistic, too. It didn't feel like it was forced or tacked on. You know, that they're still going to have issues and problems when the movie ends. Anyway, okay.
Hearing you talk about it, I kind of am okay. Like, usually whenever somebody disagrees with me on a film, so... like clearly, I'm like, no, you're wrong and I'm right. But I'm actually like, I get you. I understand. I'm willing to.
I wish I saw the movie that you saw.
Yeah,
but
you know. However, I really have to.
It's not for everyone. Yeah.
Yeah. I really have to end it at that. First of all, I agree with you in the sense that I do like films that do the other way of thinking and give you that kind of view. But I feel like if you want to see a film that gives you that and did it correctly in like actually handing you a story and an enjoyable film that you can actually look into, and like I say, go to Fish Tank.
What about Precious? You didn't like Precious?
Precious, I don't think we can write into this category.
Precious is just too contrived. They just threw too much at her. And...
Yeah, but what
Damon is being
about
funny. Damon is being
about
funny.
Is exactly what I think about this movie. That is exactly how I see this movie. I just think that it. Because it felt different, it felt fresh and wasn't, you know, run-of-the-mill to say. When people saw it, they're like, oh, finally, there's people that are still making this type of film. And they jumped on it immediately, right? if you want to say a movie, it's not low budget, but comparatively low budget, and tells a single story and doesn't use a lot of dialogue, Moon came out last year. That movie's tremendous. That movie's like a million times.
I actually would never have compared this to Moon.
Yes, in terms of budget.
No, not even talking about budget. Talking about the type of film kind of deal.
But it was solitary.
Oh, Moon was fantastic. I love it. Yeah, even though it had some problems, it had some story flaws and plot holes.
Okay.
What was that?
What were you saying?
Oh, about Moon? I'm sorry.
No, yeah,
but that was a $5 million movie,
right? But if you're going to make a movie in space, it would have been way more money than what he spent. But I'm talking about, yes, it was $5 million, but what he achieved with the $5 million is far greater than what whoever made this movie achieved with the $13.20 that he spent.
Ooh, okay.
I was more engrossed. I enjoyed this Moon a million times more. It wasn't because of the budget that made me enjoy Moon. It's because it's a better movie than this movie, for me at least. Right? We all rail against movies that are cliche and run out the middle, whatever. But there's something to be said about just doing a type of movie well. Just, yes, you're following the beat, but if you do it well, then the movie is still well done. And I didn't feel that this movie was well shot. I agree with the cinematography award, but like the movie, it just felt dull and drab, and it didn't engross me at any time. The child, he went from being the worst child of all time to being quiet and an angel. His mother said, "Don't leave the house," and he just went, "All right, sure, that's it." Some drug dealer punched me in the face, I'm done. Right? The mother went from hating the uncle and saying, "I'm selling all this shit," and then the very next scene, it was, "No, I think we should keep the shit. Let's not sell any of this shit." Is she bipolar? I don't understand. And the uncle might be bipolar. I don't like this movie. It's not. Giving me the wrap it up.
Yes, it was a mistake. So, I wanted to take a moment to discuss a topic. This film, as you mentioned, as to why you wanted to kind of watch it, was it's been garnered with so many awards. It's gone through the festivals all across the world. It got the directing and the cinematography award at Sundance in 2008. We see so many films go through the festival circuit. We personally know, but we've seen, following all the blogs online and all of the syndications, and we see them and we go yes, that movie looks good, people are talking about that one. The question I have is, do these films ever really live up to their hype, or are they really only for people who are actually at the festivals and discover them? And I think it's nice that Mel is here with us, because he actually ends up going to a lot of these festivals, and he can yes, you son of a bitch.
Well, I've only been to because I live here, the San Francisco Film Festival, I guess 5 years in a row now.
Mm-hmm.
And then a couple of years ago I went to South by Southwest, but I wanted to go to Toronto. There are a bunch of people who are still at the Cannes Film Festival, which is just wrapping up. But those are very different festivals.
Yeah.
I think Southwest and the San Francisco one are a little bit more similar in that they emphasize indie films and foreign films, along with a mix of more high-profile films that are about to get a release, but not very many. So even if they're indie films getting a release, that's one of the things I like about the SF Film Festival is that, yeah, the emphasis is on films that you're not likely to see theatrically or even get distributed on DVD.
But here's the deal. No matter which grade of film that you're going to be seeing at these festivals, you're going to technically be seeing films that people usually wouldn't be going out of their way of seeing. And then there are a certain set of those films that people end up getting behind because they're seeing it without any information usually as to what's behind it. You're just like, we're playing it at the festival, come and see it. We made it for $2. Come and look. And
I think That's why I think for so many people, Sundance is the festival to go to, because you're seeing that you're going to January, a lot of indie films, and you know, a lot of the films that I see at SF Film Festival actually premiered at Sundance. So they make their way across the United States and they go to different festivals. But Sundance is, I think, really where it begins. Toronto is great, but Toronto is basically where all of the Oscar type films are launched in September. And that's where Slumdog Millionaire, at, you know, a couple of years ago, really got a big push.
Yeah.
And that was a film that was independently financed, had a very limited distribution, but the critics who saw it there absolutely loved it. And they, and like you were talking about, they got way behind that film. And that's a film that I liked but didn't love. But it was almost admirable. They picked that film, they loved it, and I don't think, you know, there was no collusion involved. They just, this was a film that really worked for them and resonated for them. And they were able to turn that film, they were able to give it that big push. So they got exposure. So I think it got picked up there by Fox Searchlight, if I'm correct. Then it got, you know, wider distribution. And before you knew it, it's winning Best Picture, you know, 6 months later. And that doesn't happen very often. I mean, Hurt Locker was very similar, too. I think that premiered over a year ago at Toronto, had some buzz there, hit some festivals, then premiered, you know, in June. So I think the festivals can really help some films, obviously, get some exposure that they wouldn't ordinarily have gotten. I mean, on the other hand, I've been to several festivals where I've seen 20, 25 movies, and from those films, I could say three or four were watchable, three or four I'd recommend, you know? So, I mean, there's always that overkill aspect of film festivals that they're trying to get 100 movies, and, you know, they'd really love to put that in all the brochures. We have 120 movies, you know, and tens of thousands of people are going to see these films. Well, there's going to be a quality drop-off, and that does tend to happen.
So let me just ask you this one really direct question so I can make this really clear. Let's take, for example, think of a film that came out. Let's take Brick. Brick was at Sundance in 2005?
Correct, yes.
I'm assuming you weren't there at that point.
No. And I remember hearing the buzz, reading the buzz, thinking it was a great premise, and ending up having to wait over a year before I could actually see it theatrically. It was picked up in Sundance 2005, and didn't come out, I don't think, until the spring of 2006.
So my question to you is, now that you've seen all the buzz behind Brick, and finally, a year later, you finally get to see it theatrically, do you think that the buzz hurts the film, or is it only for those who were actually there at Sundance to go in thinking, it's a movie titled something about a house, and it has this dude who has three names, and...
was on a TV show.
Yeah, he was on a TV show before. I don't know this director.
That was his first feature. Because I mean, independently financed.
Yeah, people always talk about how they love to see films blind. Like, you know, the and less really we know walking in, is the more we end up enjoying it. So, do you think that the buzz from festivals hurts a film? So it's basically for those who actually go to the festivals and see them, or? For us, it's
I think for those of us who don't go and who have to listen to the 6 months of hype before a movie comes out, it can hurt, obviously, because you build up those expectations. I think that's why I think Sundance attracts so many people, because they are seeing those films for the first time. I don't know what the numbers are. The movies are premiering, meaning they haven't played anywhere else. So there are no expectations outside of maybe if it's a director or an actor, or a screenplay, premise, but you know, there isn't all that buzz that's built up. I mean, with Brick, I ended up loving the film.
Yeah.
So the buzz didn't hurt. I mean, and I had high expectations built on waiting and seeing the trailer for it multiple times. For Slumdog Millionaire, it actually hurt. Because, again, I was hearing how great this film was over and over and over again. When I finally got around to seeing it, you know, a couple months later, you know, I was like, good but not great, you know. What did they see that I didn't see in this film? And so, I mean, I just think it's a case-by-case basis. It's hard to make a generalization. I mean, I think it's fantastic for the small films that otherwise wouldn't have gotten noticed. I mean, if there wasn't Toronto, Hurt Locker wouldn't have had any of that buzz in advance to make it sort of must-see film for critics, for smaller groups, you know, who are dedicated film goers. And then build up the Oscar buzz for her. I think actually Hurt Locker was released at a bad time, but that's a separate issue. They released in the middle of June here, and they just got swarmed by all of the summer movies, you know? So, and it didn't hurt, because it still won the Oscar for Best Picture.
Are there, Damon, any films that you can think of that you had the huge buzz behind for coming out of the festivals, and it actually didn't hurt your enjoyment of the film at all?
Peacock.
That was in festivals? You don't remember which one, do you know?
No, The Hurt Locker is one that there was, like, people were falling over themselves. And it happens all the time because people like hyperbole, they can't tell themselves when they're writing. You do it a lot.
Yes.
But I don't mind it because you're new to this writing.
Yeah, I'm new. I don't know how to write.
I mean, I remember when you were writing essays with numbers, but that's just as
a point. We're going to bring that up.
I heard that, you know, The Hurt Locker was amazing, and I tracked it down and got to see it, and then I became part of the problem. I started telling everybody that it was tremendous, and like Douglas and Andrew usually do, they don't listen.
No.
That's when I thought. But then a year later, when more hype started coming out and people like, this movie is going to win Oscars and all that.
Andrew and Douglas was like, we'll finally go and watch this movie.
Yeah, Damian, this movie is really good.
I don't know, have you seen it, David?
Yeah, have I seen The Hurt Locker? They actually asked me. Like, I saw The Hurt Locker. Oh, really? It's good, isn't it? Yes. Finally. No, it happens. I'll generalize because I'm a man. I'm not so scared. I'm not scared.
You're around big.
I'm not scared. Hype hurts. It does.
Low expectations are
terms,
good.
No, not in terms of numbers, because hype builds numbers. More eyeballs see the movie because of hype.
We're not talking about money. Right? I don't care about money.
What it hurts is your enjoyment of the movie. If I had gone in and seen Iron Man with no two, with only the first teaser, I'd have liked that movie more, I'm sure of it. But the more and more you see things and you hear people and you get yourself hyped up for something, your anticipation and your expectation will always be better than what is actually seen. I remember the first time I saw Fistful of Dollars and for a dollar more, a few more dollars, whatever. I didn't know anything about those movies.
You never even...
Nothing at all. It was literally on the Western Channel and I saw Clint Eastwood.
You're like Flick.
And I went, Clint Eastwood. And I stayed. I didn't even like Westerns at the time. My grandfather was big into Westerns.
What? Hold on, stop.
There was a time when I was a child, did not like Westerns. Because my grandfather liked them, and all the ones that he watched were terrible.
He watched Bonanza, didn't
he? Right, it was literally whatever is on the Western Channel. And you'd sit there beside him and go, I'm going to go and sniff glue and kill myself because this is boring. And I saw Clint Eastwood one. And I remember Clint Eastwood from Dirty Harry. And I said, Dirty Harry is in this one. It must be good. And so it was. And I know when I talk about certain movies, I hype it up really big. Really big. I remember I said to you guys that I thought A Prophet was as good as Godfather. And I knew saying that you guys would never agree. But that's how it felt to me. That is the amount of hype and the expectation that I put on people. Knowing that most people won't agree with how I see the movie. So hype hurts when you... Because you build up the expectation. It's just too much. I mean, the big hit. You love the big hit, don't you? But I'm pretty sure it's not as mind-blowing as I said. Because that movie is phenomenal. It's transcendent. That's what that movie is. They should play that movie in heaven. That's how good that movie is. Right? But, I mean, hype just hurts how you look at the movie. You can't help it. You can't help it. You build that image in your head. You'll never live up to what you actually see.
I mean, when I think about films, like, I'm trying to think of recent films that were hyped ridiculously for me, and I still actually really love them, and I mean The Hurt Locker comes to mind, but one that I remember from last year, which actually was my number one, 500 Days of Summer. It got rave reviews out of Sundance last year, and I mean it ended up being my favorite film of last year. It's still, I think I've watched it 20 times now, and I can still go back and watch scenes and just smile watching that film.
No, you can't still love the movie. Now that's not what I'm saying.
No, yeah, I'm trying to get at you with the hype thing. But when I think of the amount of films that were hyped up and actually ended up just not hitting the mark, I mean, you gave you gave us Unprofit. I forgot about that one with your Godfather.
I stick by that.
And I think that also has to do that also we can also talk about it in reference to sequels. Everyone has a sequel argument where sequels are never as good as their original. No, there are exceptions to the rule, but generally,
Spider-Man 2 and X-Men 2 and Dark Knight,
Terminator, Alien,
Godfather 2.
Blah 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 blah. But then for every one of those, you have around 50.
Oh no, no, you're absolutely right. It's a small percentage.
Sir.
Like, what can I think of that was recent as a sequel? Transformers. Like, you know,
every time there's a remake,
a sequel, people trying to make a mark that they had before and just failing completely. And one that I know Damon will never agree with me with, but I still believe is a horrendous sequel was Quantum of Solace.
Horrendous compared to what?
It's one, one before.
I don't. Horrendous is pretty harsh. Because Pierce Brosnan was James Bond. Do you remember that?
No, but we're forgetting Pierce Brosnan. We're forgetting Pierce Brosnan.
No, no, yeah, just in comparison to Casino Royale.
Yeah,
right.
It was
serious drop off in quality. They barely had a story, and the villain was really weak.
Yes.
I kept expecting there to be another villain behind the villain, because he has a small plan.
I was wondering where the villain's mustache was that he was twirling every scene.
Well, you know, the thing I remember the most is the fight at the end, where the villain is and he are fighting in that collapsing hotel.
And the villain hurts himself.
And he's making these bizarre sounds as he's, like, lunging at him. And it sounds like a little boy, you know, it's like, well, you're not being really threatening,
sure,
even though you have an
axe,
a short axe that you're swinging wildly at the hero. He had to be the least intimidating villain ever put on film.
Yeah, but that,
and I think he's, you know, the French actor, he's well known. I just think he was miscast, and you know,
I said it before, and I'll say it again. That villain reminded me of the newspaper dude from the Pierce Brosnan one. I don't even remember which movie it is.
Yeah, but you know,
Jonathan Pryce. Jonathan Pryce, Bond Never Dies?
I don't want to remember the name of that Bond movie. It was Pierce Brosnan, and there was something with the newspapers. The World Is Not Enough?
Tomorrow Never Dies or some shit.
Yeah, Tomorrow Never Dies.
Tomorrow Never Dies.
Yeah, that was the.
Yeah.
Which was the Halle Berry one? What was the Halle Berry one?
Jesus Christ.
Die Another Day?
Die Another Day. Okay, so it's not that one.
No, it's Tomorrow Never Dies.
Tomorrow Never Dies. Okay.
He was right.
No, no, yeah, that's Jonathan Pryce, the Rupert Murdoch type guy. Michelle Yeoh was in it.
Yeah, Michelle Yeoh was in it.
It was that is
holy shit. Michelle Yeoh was in a James Bond movie. Christ.
Yeah, she was a Bond girl.
Yes, she was. Talk about
and they gave her like they gave her one action scene.
Anyone...
we know you can kick ass. Here you go.
Like, I don't think of her as a Bond girl at all. Like,
it's not your fault.
Did you ever see her in that in that kung fu film? The superhero kung fu film where she was
what?
There was a superhero kung fu film she was in.
Pretty sure there have been many. I've never seen. Right. What were you talking about again?
We were talking about film festivals and hyping up movies.
I'm glad that they do hype up the movies, because it helps me to know what to watch and what not to watch. And even when there's bad movies, even when they hype up bad movies, in my opinion, I'm glad that I don't have to go through and watch. Because what Mel said, I've heard said from a lot of people who have gone to these events, is that there are more bad movies than you can imagine, and that is why it is easy to talk about the good ones. It might help to set the bar low so that whatever is good, they hype more. But I've heard that there are some horrific, some truly horrific movies that are shown there, and then even more movies that it's just neither here nor there. It's just literally people on film. What was that movie we reviewed about the two people who had a long distance relationship?
Nights and Weekends.
Yeah, it was basically that, where they just have two people talk for 90 minutes and then that's it. The movie's done. So the hype hurts, but it's better than no hype and me wading through the darkness.
The darkness.
I prefer that. It's the same with the Oscars. Yeah, a lot of the Oscar picks we don't agree with, but it does help people who are never going to see any of those movies anyway go, alright, they said that movie is one of Oscars, so maybe we should go and see that one and that one. We don't agree because we've seen better movies most of the time. But it does help.
I guess that's the best assessment right there. Anything to add to that, Mel? At all?
Like I said, it can, you know, I think I had one year where I was just so disappointed by everything, almost everything I had seen at a festival, that it made me rethink how many movies, you know, because I was just trying to go for quantity. I'm like, you know what, I need to scale it back, go for quality, definitely use some of, you know, the sort of intel you get from earlier festivals, what sounds promising, you know. I mean, the SF Film Festival actually has a really nice brochure that they come up with, has some, you know, really good background info on every single film, you know, then go from there. But on the other hand, I also didn't get a chance to see everything I wanted to see, partly because they have limited tickets, so that's an added complication where different festivals handle that aspect differently. Sort of just as a tangent, I think Sundance is the same way, and South by Southwest, you get a badge, you wait with the badge holders. The SF Film Festival, they're very limited seats, so if you're not there an hour before, don't get a seat, you're out of luck. So you could have just wasted your time. So whatever schedule you have for the day just completely gets blown if you don't see what you wanted to see. But there were some good films. There were definitely, you know, some that surprised me, some documentaries. Those are the ones that tend to, I think, grab me the most. Some of the narrative films didn't really work for me. I'm sorry?
Sometimes I feel like I just don't watch enough documentaries. Like I'm ignoring a complete side of film.
It can be tough to do well. I've seen some that were really awful that surprised me that they made it into the festival. And just from like a technical standpoint, where they just didn't have really any idea what they were doing, that they had a topic and it wasn't particularly interesting. They didn't find people who were really articulate enough. And they just kind of stumbled through it, and they're like, "Oh, we got through 70 minutes. Okay, we'll end the documentary now." And it's like, "Wow, thanks for wasting my time. I really appreciate that."
Sounds like my high school essays.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And I guess on that note, we can end. Basically, hype helps but hurts at the same time.
It does.
It's good for pointing you in the right direction. This is the best.
And I was going to say that.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. The last thing about festivals is that you get to meet other people who have your similar interests. So whether it's just moviegoers or other critics, that to me is the highlight, actually, that you get to hang out and talk to like-minded people. And, you know, you suggest movies to each other. And sometimes, you know, you'll discover who's like a good barometer for you, who shares your taste in film. Because you could get led off straight very, you know.
Very easily.
Very easily. Very easily. You know, like, okay, I'm discounting that person's opinion because I dislike everything that they like, and vice versa. It's like, oh, you like that? Great. I won't see it now. You know?
We've met those people.
right, absolutely.
You made me watch Ballast.
I thought it was supposed to be good. I was wrong.
We've heard that many times.
Ah, that's what she said.
And with that, I guess we can go. Mel, anywhere you want to point people to before we head out?
Just again, efilmcritic.com.
and SF Station. And I've been writing for both sites for about, it'll be 5 years if it hasn't been already. And it was, 5 years in May. We're in May. And I can't believe how long it's been. And I was writing for another site, which I'm no longer writing for, called Movie Vault. Did that from, I think, 2004 to 2007. So they're all out there. Over 1,100 reviews.
Wow. Congrats on that.
I guess. I'm like, really? I wrote that much?
Really? As usual, you can find the podcast on gmanreviews.com, and you can subscribe to us via iTunes.
Not RSS, though.
It's working, I'm sure. And yeah, that's it for the week. We'll be back next week. I'm Andrew.
This is Damian.
You can find me on Twitter at gmanreviews, and you can find all of my writing at gmanreviews.com. And Damien can't be phoned, apparently, so...
Damn right.
With that, we'll go. Good night.
How's those Facebook privacy options working out for you bastards, huh?
Something like that. Laters.
Tweetle. That you always wear a